Hi, from Issaquah, Washington, this is Deepak Singh.
And from Cambridge, MA, this is Hari Jairam.
And you're listening to The Coast.
To Coast.
Bio. Podcast. Hey, Hari, how are you?
Hey, very good. All right, before we start, Skype seems to be acting up today, so let's hope we can get through this without any interruptions.
We've only had one mishap. It normally happens, actually. I mean, just so people know, Hari and I actually record our separate audio streams on our own recording software, and then Hari mails me his final MP3 file, and I merge the two streams together along with the music and things like that and do the editing and so on. And the reason we do that is we don't have sophisticated equipment that allows me to have multi-channel recording going in. Don't have a mixer that will allow me to do that anymore. I used to, not now. But the other reason is that it's also, you know, this is something I learned from John O'Dell, because he does it that way. And when I got interviewed by him, he suggested doing it that way. Skype's unreliable. I mean, even during a regular conversation that Hari and I will have when we record the podcast, there'll always be moments when Hari breaks up. And I'm sure it happens going in that direction for me as well. And so by recording our own streams, we ensure higher fidelity recording, and you don't hear crackles and, you know, the funny stuff that you often get when people are recording over Skype. So it's actually one reason we haven't really had guests on board, because it does require, the way we do it, the guests do their own recording stream. My guess is that most of the people that we will end up interviewing have recording software of their own, and it will not be that big a deal.
Hey, I use Audacity, so it's open free, so everybody should be able to. If you can get on Skype, you can probably record a conversation using Audacity.
Yeah, so whenever we get down to, you know, getting Ricardo and a few other people on, up in the friend feed stream today, John, I can never pronounce his last name, so I won't try. He's a librarian, and he said after listening to our library thing from last time, and I actually put up the podcast only today because I was traveling Thursday, Friday, and I was completely exhausted yesterday. He said that you should have a librarian as a guest on your show, and I'm like, cool. We should. Having said that, what were you up to last week?
A lot of stuff. We started, did I tell you about the torpedo fish?
No. Are you talking about science, or are you talking about something else?
Actually, I'm talking about science. No, our lab started to do some live biology, I guess. We started my boss was showing one of the postdocs in the lab how to purify protein from torpedo ray. So this is not something I did, but at least I got to see a lot of it happen. We got this nice old fish sent to us with somebody in California, and we were we watched as boss cut it open, and he even invited me to touch the electric organ. So these are basically these flat fish that swim around. They lie on the bottom, I guess, and every time a fish comes by, they fold their wings upward and zap the fish. That's how they hunt. And of course, it turns out that the organ, the electric organ that they have, that they use to zap fish with, is what has the protein that we are interested in. Anyway, so yeah, I was like, he's like, we should touch and see if it's still alive, and it works. And I did touch it, but unfortunately, the guy was a little sick, I think, when he came in. But that was probably the most exciting thing I did last week, was touch the electric organ of a torpedo ray.
You know, that just sounds bad.
I know. It probably does, but trust me, it is the coolest thing ever to be able to purify protein from something. You know, I have done like cow eyes and things like that before, but this just somehow seems so cool, because you have this fish and you cut it open and, you get at the protein from there. I mean, it's such good old school but so relevant science that all right, I won't call it the electric organ from now on, but that's what it is.
Talking about cow bovine eyes, I have this.
Oh, thank God. I thought you were going to say talking about electric organs. Did you see this post about this Korg or something? Anyway, never mind.
No. You know, I'm not that inventive. I should have said something like that. No. In graduate school, my lab was essentially studying,
Rhodopsin.
We were an opsin group. Uh-huh. One day, there was this ice box outside my boss's office, and my lab was in this office complex, which had a couple of faculty members, my advisor's secretary, a meeting room, and this computer lab, which was where I sat. Mm-hmm. And so I get in, and there's this freezer box sitting over there, and I sort of curiously open it, and I see all these cow eyes staring at me.
That was my day one when I was a master's student. I got a bag full of cow eyes. It reminded me of what was it like? Eyeball soup in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which of course we Indians eat every day.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Just like we eat chilled monkey brain.
Yeah.
I always find that very funny. Anyway, getting on to more serious stuff.
And that's a lot of serious stuff today, right?
Yeah. And I guess the first thing we wanted to talk about was, I guess it's primarily a post by Cameron, which has this really cool title of, let me get to it, if I can find it. It's called "There Are Crowds and Then There Are Crowds." Cameron's been writing some really, really good blog posts lately. And Cameron and I also teed off a couple of sessions at the Science Blogging Conference, Science Online Conference earlier this year, sort of on these themes of networks in science and crowdsourcing and so on. And of course, Cameron's been doing some very in-depth writing on that subject, doing presentations and thinking a lot. So he starts off from a talk that John Wilbanks gave at ETEC. And in a bit, we'll come to your discovery of John Wilbanks, which I think was kind of cool. John Wilbanks gave a talk at ETEC, which is an O'Reilly Emerging Technologies Conference, or is it a Technology Reviews Conference up in Boston. The talk was on open data and building data commons. And apparently there was a quote from the talk that got a lot of publicity. And the quote was, "There is no crowd." And Cameron believes that John, when he said that, meant the scientific communities are not large and homogeneous enough for the kind of crowdsourcing and opinion markets that sort of drive collective intelligence applications. I've talked about that a lot and over the years, because you just don't get the network effects that you would need to make some of these things successful, such as social networks in science. And of course, there's something called the Polymath Project, where it tried to solve a defined mathematical project, a problem with small contributions from a group of people. And it basically said how this type of project does not work. There's a blog post associated with that. And apparently the failure was the team of actively involved people was rather small and made up of people who might be seen as the usual suspects. All right. You know, a bunch of mathematicians available on the web. So Cameron basically goes on to say that there's two types of crowdsourcing. One is this wisdom of crowds, network effects thing that we talk about. And the second type of crowdsourcing is what he calls a broadcast request, broadcast and response kind of approach. To me, that's something like a niche network in a way, where you have some loose network mm-hmm. of experts and it allows you through network effects to get a response. And I think what he basically says is that scientists tend to try and mix these two up while they're completely, in a way, they're completely distinct from each other. Of course, there's a lot of detail in his blog post on what works and what doesn't work. And as somebody who's somewhat outside this, discussion, I was wondering what you had to say about Cameron's post and I guess John's post, which you got a chance to read as well.
Yeah, as you said, I did discover John Wilbanks as a result of this article and the other one that I guess we'll talk about in a few seconds. But I absolutely, this was a very nice way to look at the whole issue of, you know, science networks and so on. And I very much agree with what John and Cameron say. You know, I think we do have very small niches. I mean, you know, especially at the level of science that most of us do. Everybody, I mean, has their small communities, and that's why science conferences are still so well attended, because, you know, that's when you meet your limited community. And I guess we will never get to the stage that we'll have something like the network effects will probably, just by the nature of what we do, the network effects probably won't apply to a lot of what we do. But the only thing I have to say in defense of, you know, the traditional network effects are, like, so in crystallography, right, we have a community, which is it's called the CCP4BB, the CCP4 bulletin board. And just about everybody who's a crystallographer, probably, who, you know, does crystallography daily and who really is vested in the technique and, you know, the developments and the right from, like, if you're a student to a postdoc to obviously a practicing crystallographer, is on this bulletin board, right? So, and it's been around for at least since 1996 or so. So just about around the time when email was becoming big. Now, that's a good example because a lot of those people, I don't see them anywhere else on the web. But that's a great community that works and is very vibrant. And, you know, the web's been, you know, the social web has been around for a few years, but I almost can guarantee myself that I won't see those people on any of, you know, the other communities. And I think that's a problem in all of science, is that we do have our crowds. They're probably sizable, but they're not going to jump on board with something else because they already have something that works. It's kind of like, you know, even in the coding world, right? You have so many, you know, programming languages, and each programming language has its own kind of community. And of course, I mean, a lot of them, because most of what they do is computers, are on the web, but you don't see them all in one place.
Actually, and, you know, that's not necessarily true, though.
Well, yeah, so you have, what's Stack Overflow, right?
Sites, I mean, so I think the point here is, and I think I understand your point, sites like Stack Overflow will not work in the sciences because you don't have a general enough audience.
Correct, exactly. That's what I was getting to,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Even if you're a programmer, right, if you're doing like Python, you still probably are vested in, you know, like the general aspects of recursion or, you know, things like whatever, you know, pointers. I mean, take some example,
yeah.
Right? Coding is abstracted enough that you can gain a lot from what somebody else is doing. That is true in the sciences too, but only it's perhaps less true. And maybe our niches are so much more well-defined that we already have a working community. And so we do have our own kind of crowd that has its own way of doing, you know, keeping in touch. There's, I'm sure, quite a few like email news groups and stuff, which we don't even know about, right? R has its own group, for example. And, you know, so I think the nice thing I see from all this is, yeah, we don't have the luxury of everybody being interested in one thing, because that's why we are all scientists doing research, is because we are all interested in what interests us, and we find our own communities. And it'll be a long time, I think, till, you know, there's a general enough platform like Stack Overflow or even like Nature Network Boston, right? There's, I don't follow NNB that much nowadays, but there are quite a lot of micro communities within NNB. But NNB itself is not so big that, you know, everybody's talking about the same thing, kind of like the social web.
Yeah,
so,
and I don't think you'll ever get big enough. I mean, to make these things work, you need tens of thousands of people. And,
right, right.
Know, I except for a few scientific disciplines, there are just a few, maybe none. I mean, the reason bioinformaticians can get along is there's some general skills that everybody needs.
Right, it's like, kind of the same through. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, I mean, a guy who's an expert in one area can still help out somebody in another area. But
right.
Somebody who's, you know, a biophysicist is not going to help somebody do PCR. Unless they were once a molecular biologist or something like that.
Right, exactly. And the chances are, like, in the whole biophysics community, you know, if somebody wants to learn how to do PCR, he'll still ask the community, and somehow they'll manage to get the information in, you know. it's a little different for scientists to go, hey, I want to learn PCR today. All right, let me go and look at, the PCR room on Friend Feed or something, right? I think you tend to stick with what you
Well,
know,
see,
your
actually,
own.
the PCR room in Friend Feed is
Is there really a room? I just made
it's
that
a
up.
no, it isn't. But it's like
Oh.
having your own forum. It's just that it's a different way
Right.
of doing it. So
Exactly.
it's not a network effect in general as such. I mean, although I think the fact that it's in a general purpose situation allows you to get people who might never find you otherwise. I think the
Right.
advantage of the quote unquote social web is people find you
No,
accidentally.
correct.
In it's a it while if you are in a Chrislog on CCP4, you have to actively go to CCP4 because you wanted to go to CCP4.
Right, exactly. And they are fairly like their own kind of separate communities. You need to sign up, you have a password, all this stuff. But yeah, it's
Serendipitous discovery is not exactly the hallmark of, yeah. I
the
mean, I
old
completely
web.
agree. I mean, there's CCL, Computational Chemistry List.
Right.
For
Like
computational chemists, which I used to be regular a regular all the at. Now that I'm not doing it full time, the software, the way it works is so arcane. I don't go there anymore, but I'm sure I mean, I know Rajarshi and I'll spend a lot of time there.
Right.
So I completely agree there. I mean, that's I
I
think
think
so.
one good thing, like I was looking on Friend Feed that they like Nature had a competition to get your boss to blog, right? This was to encourage mainstream scientists to kind of start blogging. I think one thing a lot of the social network groups can start doing is convince, I mean, it's going to be hard, but convince these existing communities to kind of move to a same platform so that at least it allows what you were saying, like discovery. It's easier for me to discover a crystallography room on Friend Feed if I'm already on Friend Feed, then for me to, if I'm on Friend Feed and I need to like go and get onto the CCP4 BB, So I think, yeah, the maybe the next wave should be to get these micro communities to hopefully accept, I don't know, pick your
Well, I
social
think
web platform.
I think the way it will evolve is you have micro communities and there's communities next to your community, right? So the
Right, yeah.
molecular biologists and cell biologists might talk to each other every now and then or something like that. Or molecular biologists and bioinformatics people often talk to each other. I mean, that sort of goes together. And then they start meshing and you spread out like that. I think it'll have to be step by step. I don't think you can just assume
Yeah.
that it's going to happen.
And I think a lot will change also in the next, say, 5 or 7 years when everybody who grew up with social networking will kind of be in grad school or something, So it's different then. It's just, it's very difficult to convince someone who's, say, 13 today to use email as his primary way of keeping in touch with his community like 7 years from now. So I'm sure
Yeah, actually, I
changes.
heard about something like that. I was listening to a Scientific American podcast on cloud computing and big data, and actually, the most interesting part of that was a discussion on patents versus markets as a way of innovation. But in the cloud computing part, there was this guy who was somebody was saying, "So how is adoption going to happen?" He says adoption, and he mentioned some famous paper apparently, and I'll have to go track it down. I'll put it in the show notes. Where somebody basically says innovation in the academic sciences happens when people die.
Which is, I guess, a more shocking way of saying what I just said,
Basically the old guard
goes away. So.
goes something along those lines. Basically, when we've always said that also, right? How's
Right.
adoption of social networks going to happen is when young people get into
Science, yeah.
roles. Well, when say Jean-Claude Bradley becomes a dean or something like that, you can imagine the impact
Yeah.
it might have
Right.
to do that and so on and so forth. So
But
but I found that quite interesting. I'll track it down and I'm sure that's a nice paper to read.
right. But it's, I mean, we see it everywhere, right? I mean, every social network that, I mean, other than like a Nature Network, right? It just seems like it's really hard going because what John Wilbanks is talking about, 0.005% of, of the sciences is probably still a lot less than 0.005% of the rest of the world, which gets you Flickr,
Yeah,
which
so
is
there's a
very
reason
well
for
put,
that, right? In any community, and the specific ratios change. You have a set of active contributors, you have a set of active participants, and you have a set of passive, occasional, you know, people are basically just consuming, just reading passively. And that ratio is usually 10%, 10%, and 80%, or 5%, 15%, and 80%, where the lower percentages are the contributors and the active people. But for that to be sustained, that lower percentage of people has to be a sufficient quantity. You know, 10,000, 15,000. Those percentages don't change in science. They're just the same as in anything else.
Probably are.
Except that the quantities are smaller. So it doesn't, you know, so it doesn't work because of that. So, I mean, maybe it'll work someday when people die off or something like that. You're being very morbid. But seriously, and talking about scientists and people dying off and sort of...
Oh, goodness. All right. I can't wait to see where this goes.
This segue. So the other day, Bjorn Brems posted this note on friend feed,
which said, can someone
confirm that Jove has gone closed access? I'm one of the associate editors and don't know about it. That particular thread is long. I mean, it is long.
I'm sorry. The only reason I'm laughing is at the segue talking about dying off is, it sounds like, Jove's open access has
Jove has always had, and I think that's the point that John Wilbanks made in his blog post, that Jove was never, quote-unquote, open access. They never had Creative Commons licensing. They never had a public domain dedication. They didn't.
Hey, Atom, should we just backtrack and give a background for those who missed the probably longest discussion thread that I have seen?
It's the longest discussion thread I have seen as well. And it was a very interesting discussion thread because we started off by saying it's April 1. people suddenly started seeing that they couldn't see video and so on and so forth. And so I think I was the one who says, it's April 1, could it be related to that? And people said, no, it isn't. And very quickly, Nikita Bernstein, whom I don't know if you know Nikita, I've had a chance to meet him. He's a...
She and Moshe.
Nikita the guy. So Moshe is the CEO, Nikita the CTO. So he's a software guy.
I see.
So Nikita showed up on the blog post saying, we are indeed closing access. It's not an April Fool's joke. We've been trying to get universities to subscribe to us, but nobody seems to be taking us seriously, which is what led to my people dying off comment. That the people to take them seriously are like, just imagine if Jean-Claude Bradley had, you know, somebody making that decision.
The reins of someplace and Joe approached him. Yeah,
exactly. Nobody seems to be taking us seriously, and given our situation, being free is just not sustainable. However, we are now discussing how to provide a good blend of access and subscription. For example, authors should definitely have access to their own articles. If you have any other suggestions, all would be welcome. So that was the first statement confirming what is happening. And keep...
That they were starting to charge for people to go and look at videos on their site, which are very high quality and which were always free to watch, kind of like YouTube. Like, you needed a sign-in, right? Or no, you didn't even need a sign-in. You could just go and watch them.
Watching was completely unrestricted. And I think you and I have talked about this in the past, was I didn't know what the burn rate was, but, you know, professional production crews are expensive. I think people...
So Jove was actually, just to give a background for those who don't know the what went on. Jove was actually hiring professional film crews and sending them out across the country, filming, protocols as you were doing them. And these were professional film crews, which were highly trained, and, you know, they would zoom in at the right time and do everything just as you would. The production quality is very good.
Jean-Claude noted that they were doing multiple takes and things like that to get it right. And just to even go back one step further, Jove is a journal of visualized experiments. And their ambitions were not just to be a video site. Their ambitions were, and still are, to be a publication, a formal publication with DOIs to visually show experimental protocol. So think of...
Right. And I think sometime last year, they actually got indexed by PubMed. So you could have a submission to Jove, and you go through kind of a semi-formal process of writing up your protocol, sending it to the editor. They go through it, and they kind of talk over how the filming would work. They schedule a filming day, and the professional crew shows up. And they spend sometimes, some of our protocols are 2 to 3 days long. They spend the whole time, film the whole thing, then it's pushed as edited and pushed as video on the site with a digital object identifier. And as of sometime last year, it was actually indexed by PubMed as well.
Yeah,
Right?
correct. And that was quite mon I mean that was quite an achievement actually, because for a
Yeah.
young startup journal to get to this page with a very new model. But as it turns out, and I think the community once, especially, and I think most they had to I think the mistake they made was they didn't communicate it to certain people upfront. They just did it, and some of the people who've been their biggest champions obviously said, it shouldn't have been such a surprise. And yeah, so we were busy exchanging posts. There was some initially there was a lot of hostility, but I think the people understood in the end. And Ewan and Lars and I were arguing, it does cost money to do something like that. And Moshe sent out an email later saying that cost him about $6,000 an episode or something.
Right, he said that's about how much an average episode of $6,000. That's a lot of money, and that's why they said they couldn't sustain it. Sending all these film crews and giving away everything for free. They were backed by venture funding or angel funding. I'm not sure. Of course, as with most things, the money does run out, and that's when they started. They kind of pull the plug on open access, and this whole thread started because one of the guys who's on the editorial, what's his name,
Bjorn
Bjorn,
Brems.
Bjorn Brems, who's on the editorial team, asked a question saying, "Can someone confirm that it's gone close? I'm on the editorial team and I don't know about it." And then, of course, I mean, the way this was quite a sad way for him to find out over friend feed, that it has gone closed, and there was a lot of heated conversation. Something like 300 threads later, I'm really starting to appreciate the whole, the two sides of the story.
And I made the point in the blog post in the friend feed thread, and I think there's a couple of other people who sort of agreed, is when you start something like Jove, and I don't know what their cost structure is, I don't know how the money is spent, so I'm just doing a very general approach philosophy, is you look at your you you know Peter Drucker, who is a big management guru, always said that you don't do cost-based pricing, you do price-based costing. You figure out what is a sustainable price for your product, and then you build a cost structure that allows you to sustain that price. And I think the mistake Jove made was they decided that they were going to go for, and sometimes that's the best way to do it. Go to the highest possible video and go with a certain structure, and then and without compromising, so they're not completely into white labeling and they want to maintain that brand. But I think given, and this is the classic case of, there are just not enough people who'll be willing to, who'll be willing to support such a medium, which means that even people paying for it to get themselves video published, that's not going to happen.
Correct.
Institutions are not there yet. Advertising, they'll never get the eyeballs. How many people want to see a mouse getting dissected? There'll be a few people in the world interested in one specific video. So, and advertising on the web works on breadth, on volume. That's why Hulu can charge many a very high CPM. I think we've discussed it for Bioscreencast, where very early on we figured that advertising, even if you wanted to do it, was just not sustainable because it's a very niche area. Maybe you can get a few one or two big hunking subscribe. Advertisers to do it, but then you need an ad sales group to get that. It's a lot of work, and it's really hard. And it's not just Jove. The entire publishing industry is in a mess. Revision 3 had to cut a bunch of shows, and they're a very successful video site with advertising. So it's an uphill battle under any circumstances. So I wish them luck because what they were doing is truly innovative, and it's really pushing the boundaries. So
Correct.
I hope it works out.
Right. And actually, the good thing that came out of all this was, I mean, obviously a very good conversation. And John Wilbanks, to me, I think his summary was really nice because he basically talked about the fact that we, like, I, so. A lot of people on the friend feed thread were very annoyed because they said, okay, here we have these guys who claim they're open access, and then suddenly one day the open access is gone, And John's post basically addresses that, saying, okay, if just saying you're open access, it's not a label you can just put on, you can't just use it as a mantra and expect everybody to believe you. So if you think open access is important, you need to go and look at the actual, licensing terms and so on. In Jove's defense, and that's what he said, is they never really said they're, I mean, they said, oh, they had a few words here and there that said they were open access, but when you actually looked at, I mean, I guess he looked at it, but look at the licensing terms and whatever, actual legalese there was backing their site. They weren't really open access, and I think that's one thing we all need to pay. I mean, speaking as a scientist, like when we start using these terms, we need to actually probably go and look up and actually abide by the licenses that are there, and also use the correct licenses so we send the right message. So if anything, Joe was guilty of being vague, and that's perhaps quite bad when you piss off your community because you're vague. But then again, I
I
guess
actually
his
don't even think they
Michael,
were vague deliberately. I think they were vague because, like a lot of people, they don't
they didn't know.
understand what open access means. The reason I like Creative
Right.
Commons so much, and the reason Larry Lessig set up Creative Commons, was people are stealing music. Right, they're sharing it for free. What if there was a formal mechanism which allowed people to give away music, yet maintain ownership and some rights and controlling those rights? Yeah, in the US, you can't even give data away, right? It has to be a public domain dedication. You have to dedicate it to the public domain. You can't just say it's there. You have to formally do it.
Right.
And Creative Commons Zero essentially is a more formalization of the PDE, public domain dedication.
Yeah, and we talked about, in fact, only after this whole controversy, I could appreciate why you talked about CC0, a couple of episodes back. And I think, yeah, I mean, from now on, if I really care about something, I'm going to start putting, these licensing terms on there, so it's very clear. The cool thing about John Wilbanks was he said Joe was he coined the term pyrite OA, like fool's gold, and he said, and I think we should start using it. I mean, basically, what John Wilbanks's point is that they were like fool's gold. I mean, you saw open access a few places, and you assumed that it's open, but there weren't the licenses and the other formal declarations or dedications, as you would call them, backing that claim. So that's why they were pyrite, like fool's gold, pyrite OA, open access.
I
So,
like your
yeah, I.
response on the blog post.
Right. So, and that's when I didn't even know who John Wilbanks was, but I liked the post so much that I replied. And basically saying that, I think the greatest thing, that's what we talked about too, Joe was and is an innovative concept, and I hope they survive. And I think the nicest thing they did was to popularize video as a means for formal publication. I mean, to come up and say that you can have a video protocol and that'll be permanently indexed with the digital object identifier. That was really cool, and it's something that really caught on, thanks in large part to Jove. And I think the other thing, I don't know if I said it here, is I think one thing we're really missing is it doesn't require a $6,000 video to convey a lot of these points well. And I really hope that kind of like, the make videos, the make magazine videos, and there's a lot of protocol-y kind of handycam grade videos out there which are as good about conveying the point. And I really hope that, just because if whatever happens to Jove, I hope we see a lot more of that, because you don't need to zoom into the tip of the pipette when a liquid droplet's falling off to get the point, but it helps. And I hope that, we see a lot of these handycam grade videos, and that those kind of keep a site that does have high quality video in business, only because if you want to really see, you probably wouldn't mind paying like a few dollars to see a video. Like, I've bought screencasts on the web for like a few dollars, but if you tell me that I'm going to have to pay like, an annual subscription for a site like Joe, I probably wouldn't. But I think, a model that might work is you have a lot of content that keeps people coming to your site, and the real high quality ones are, you pay for, and you maybe pay for a single click, and you download it or something. And of course, they have to worry about DRM and all that stuff. Hopefully,
well, it doesn't even have to
there,
be DRM. But... So I can, there's like any number of possibilities here. One, and you're right. I mean, I carry now, thanks to, I mean, you got your wife a Kindle. My wife got me a Kodak ZI6, which is like a flip mino HD type camera, right? You have a $250 camera with high def, 720p in your hand. With a tripod, right, you can self-publish. The way I think it works is you have journals. I think what would have worked for somebody like Jove, and I'm, again, this is us talking, you know, but then we have a podcast, we can talk. And this is what I was suggesting, is their strength, I think, is not the journal, is that they've developed this protocol of how to get video crew somewhere, work out something, record it at really high quality, and publish it. Now, what happens if they work with nature protocols and give nature protocols one more medium of publishing? Nature protocols is fine, right? Nature is a bigger company. They can absorb some loss, or they have a more way to monetize it. Plus, nature has the ad sales team that allows them to monetize things like that, right?
And they have,
and
the,
they
branding.
Have the branding. And so when they go to university by the way, we have video, you know, so-and-so, blah, 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 right? Now, there's another ways to it, and one of the ones you were alluding to is, for example, you can have two videos. One's a lower resolution video, which you watch on the web, and that's fine. And then you have the high-res video, and you do the peep code thing. You micropayment. Each video has a certain cost. And not everybody's going to download it, right, but some people who are really interested will pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, I have paid for, you know, a few screencasts that I've seen free versions of around the web. But, you know, I after seeing something like that, I didn't like it, or I didn't get as much out of it. And I've gone and paid, you know, $5. I mean, that's like buying a book, but I got a lot of value. That's how I learned Git,
actually. Yeah, so from the PeepCode screencast, I think, right?
Yeah, from the PeepCode screencast. I think it was $9. Yeah. So it was almost as much as, you know, a paperback book. And I don't regret it at all. And I think that's probably, I would do it for video protocols. But I don't think even though I'd like video and there's a lot to be gained from watching a video, I don't think I can recommend a $2,400, you know, subscription to something like Jove.
I actually also feel that pure video in a protocol sense is limiting. That's my feeling. That nature protocols having high-res video as part of their offering is a killer proposition, in my opinion.
Right. In fact, it's funny. I kind of knew that Jove was going to start charging for even publication back in, I think, December of last year, because one of the Jove editors approached me and kind of our lab to do a protocol for Jove, because they didn't have much memory and protein stuff on there. And I actually wrote it up. But as I was writing it up, I actually, you know, I wrote up the whole protocol. I said, okay, you know, everything on here, there's no added value I can perceive in watching it happen, other than probably, you know, jogging your mind a little. But it, pretty much what is written is, and I actually checked this out by giving it to somebody else in the lab and saying, hey, can you read this? And this was a new person in the lab. And she's like, yeah, it's pretty cool. I like this. I said, what would you think about watching this on video? And, you know, and they said, yeah, it'll be useful. But then again, would you pay, you know, $2,400 for a institution to do that? No. So I think, you know, a lot of these protocols are written, if they're written well, you can almost get it. You know, there's not that much to be gained by watching a video. Now, of course, if it's something complex, then you need a video. But there's not that many things in our space, I think, that requires video.
Yeah, anyway, I mean, one possibility is that Jove does stays independent, becomes a protocol journal. And as part of what they offer, you have the option of downloading high-res video, which you pay for. I don't know. It's going to be fascinating, because this is, they are early adopters. The economy is also tough. Publishing industry, they're sort of being hit by the perfect storm right now. So it's tough to fault them. I mean, they had a vision, it was a good one, and it's not done yet. Who knows, they'll come up with something very interesting. But you and I have so enough interest, and, you know, just for the sake of this full disclosure, which we should, Hari and I and a few other people started bioscreencast.com, which has a complete opposite philosophy, which is you have a screen capture device, record whatever you're doing, doesn't matter what the resolution is, and put it up there. And that was kind of what the philosophy of BioScreencast was self-publishing for fun, to share how you work with software. Because and screencasting and software is a proven and tested field. You know, people use them, and you and I we watch screencasts all the time. So,
right, and there's something to be said about self-publishing. And I hope, you know, you were saying, right, these handy cams are coming out there, which are HD quality. And maybe if Joe sticks around for a few more years, when everybody can, you know, zoom and at super high resolution using a handheld device, maybe we'll see a lot more video protocols that don't take $6,000.
And for example, you can have an editorial group that basically approves quality. You can't just submit anything; it has to meet certain standards, which aren't too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So moving off the whole video and licensing and everything, and nobody died at this point. But they could, because we're talking about healthcare records. There's this really nice blog post I found, and I don't even remember where. It had a cool title, which says, "Imagine someone had been managing your data, and then you looked." It's written by somebody who comes from the medical hospital side, health IT, health record side. And the blog post is fascinating. It essentially talks about this guy's experience. Their hospital has an interface into Google Health. And as an experiment, he uploaded his data from their EMR system, which is rare in the hospital world. He says, we have one, PHR system, sorry, and pushed it out onto Google Health. And
what's
personalized
PHR
health
system?
Record.
Sorry.
An EMR is electronic medical record. An electronic medical record includes billing information and so on, while a personalized health record is your health record. Nothing, you know, it's just that part. And Google's health is Google's PHR on the web, and Microsoft's equivalent is Health Vault. So he pushed it, and he got terrible results. It was listing diseases or something that he'd had many years ago, didn't have anymore. And that was because of the way their system sent data. So he said, if he had not done this, he would have never have found out how bad the results were. And the reason it was happening was what their system was actually sending was insurance data, not their actual health record of the patient. And so it's a question of not garbage in, garbage out, but garbage out, garbage in. If you're transmitting crap, Health Vault or Google Health are going to take in crap. But the point he was trying to make is we should all start doing this, because until we do it, we'll not find out what's wrong with all these systems. And the people who are developing the systems and the people who are interfacing with them will not be able to fix things, you know. Towards the end, he says a few things. He says, I work with data in my day jobs. So this is for a software company. I think he's got a PHR at this hospital, patient site or something it's called. We import and export data all the time. So he understands data models. And his suspicion is that data integrity in healthcare is largely absent by ordinary business standards. And he says, my hospital is one of the more advanced in the US in the use of electronic medical records. So he says, there are probably other institutions where things are even worse. And, you know, what he goes on to say is this is not a slam on Google Health. But his point is that his data was already in the PHR uninspected. It was being managed by the hospital. And then I decided to look at it and push it into Google Health and see how it was managed. It was just the way it was being held in the hospital system and what was being pushed out to Google didn't make any sense. And so he says people need to start doing it. Otherwise, when push comes to shove, it'll be a complete disaster. So his advice in the end to e-patients, if people want to keep electronic records, is A, find out what's in your medical record, medically speaking, and correct what's wrong today. Get started manually moving your data into Google Health, Health Vault, or some such system. Let's start working now on a reliable, interoperable data model. I think all of us can relate to that. But he says, I've talked to enough e-patients to be confident that we patients want working interoperable data. And it'll be what we want. If your vendor community can't figure it out, we'll start growing one. And it's an interesting viewpoint. And this last thing, of course, he argues for an open source EMR PHR, which I know my friend Fred Trotter and others in the health IT floss-based world are talking about. But I think this point that he made was, we ought to get our data into secure online systems, and we shouldn't expect it to happen with the push of a button. It will take work. So the punchline, so let's get to work. Because in the end, it'll be good for you.
Yeah.
So I really like that. Really like the post. It's a little convoluted and difficult to read, but I think he makes his points in the end.
Awesome. Yeah, I have to check it out. I'm guilty of not having read.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing it made me do when I was sort of reading it earlier today is I think, you know what? I should set up my PHR.
Right.
It's worth it. I don't think I can push it from my hospital or whatever, but it's good to have that record around. And I know in Germany, for example, they were discussing giving people an ID card with a chip. And one of the things they were discussing was how much memory there should be on the card based on what kind of medical records you will carry. So maybe it's just a blood type and things like that. But there were some people who were saying you should carry your genotype as well, for example.
Why not?
You can fit it in. Yeah.
Right.
So that was my e-health thing. And I think it's a general rule, right? Very often when you're doing something new, you have to use it. Otherwise, you'll never figure out what's wrong. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Test early. Who was that?
Paul,
guy, right?
Paul Buchheit.
Buchheit. Yeah. There you go.
Same principle, except that with code, instead of code here, you're doing it with systems. So then the problem is a lot more complex because there's not one person who can impact it directly. But
so the guy who wrote the post, is he a doctor?
I think he's just a patient with an interest. He's a with an interest in these e-patient systems.
And I think there's quite a lot of doctors out there. I mean, people in the inside the healthcare system, who I guess it needs people like that to help tune these systems to actually start working.
He's a high tech marketer, and he's basically a patient. And he's an advisor he's a patient advisor, basically. So, so he's not a healthcare person. He's somebody who uses these systems, but has the technical expertise to understand some of the problems. It came out quite nicely. So, yeah, from that perspective, I guess that's it for our formal lineup, which we figured would take a bit of time, and we are already 47 minutes in. So we have a couple of tidbits, and then we have our links. The first tidbit is yours, so I'll let you go with it, about Python.
PyCon, I guess, recently concluded. This is the annual Python conference, which is very well attended from what I've heard. And one of the things that they were talking about was to actually start using a distributed version control system for Python. So I guess Python was previously using a Subversion, which is not as distributed, or maybe they were using CVS. It doesn't matter, but they voted, and in the end, the benevolent dictator for life, Guido Van Rossum, stepped in and said, all right, I'm using my dictatorial powers to pick one of the two top contenders. And the two top contenders were Bazaar and Mercurio. And I think they're both written in Python, but that had nothing to do with his decision. Of course, Git was on there too. But Guido wrote a small post which said that, I didn't pick Git because the people who don't like Git have very strong opinions about why they don't
all the
like
Ruby
Git
people
or what
use
they don't
it.
Like about. No. Actually, I think he has a point. All right. I obviously am. I suck off the Python teat all the time, and I would tend to agree with anything Guido says because he's saying it. But it's the same way with Git, right? I mean, a lot of people started using Git was because Linus Torvalds is behind it. But apparently these other systems, I use Git. I mean, but these others like Bazaar and Mercurial, Mercurial is very popular in the Java world.
And Chris Lasher, for example, is a big Bazaar fan, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So Bazaar and Mercurial ended up being the top two contenders because of the naysayers who didn't like Git, and how, there's quite a lot of things with Git where which aren't very intuitive, I must admit. And so anyway, finally Guido stepped in and said, "I'm going to pick Mercurial for the distributed version control system for Python from going here on forward." So it is a nice post, and of course, I think the BDFL concept's very neat, and the BDFL stepped in to pick Mercurial, and I thought that is a kind of a neat story on the battle between the version control systems, and finally they've picked Mercurial. I've used Mercurial just once actually for, I think, NetBeans. I started checking out NetBeans Python, which is the NetBeans is amazing. I mean, if
NetBeans
anybody
has a
has,
good Ruby IDE as well.
yeah, they've been going after Ruby,
Yeah.
JavaScript, PHP, and
Sun in general is very big on Ruby because of JRuby.
Right, and same because of Jython, they got into like Python, and that's it's still in beta, but the beta is pretty awesome. So anyway, so yeah, that was the first tidbit at least.
Yeah,
And
talking. I think it speaks to basically it speaks to one thing. Distributed version control systems are it now.
correct, yeah,
I think
people.
subversions being the workhorse for the software development world for the last seven, six, seven, 8 years. But I think with Google Code now starting to support Git, Python choosing Mercurial. Linux on Git, Rails on Git, Mozilla on Git, and all these other.
A lot of Python is on Git too,
No,
so
the basic thing is that Git, and I think Git and Mercurial are the two I think that are very popular. All the Bazaar is quite popular with some people too. I mean, I think
And Subversion's pretty
yeah, I mean,
popular
Subversion's
too,
still
but
popular. I mean, it's the biggest. It's
yeah, it still rules
by a
the
long
roost, right?
shot. And SourceForge is still Subversion, right? But I think it's pretty clear that the way software is developed now, it's that the whole DCVS or whatever, DVCS approach is here to stay. It's not just a bunch of geeks who like it. It's actually mainstream now. I think the last 6 months to a year have definitely proved that, starting with Rails moving to Git and now Python moving to Mercurial. Also, didn't Guido just step down as a benevolent dictator for life?
I think that was April Fool's Day
I just
thing.
I vaguely
I'm
remember seeing
sure it
something,
was.
but
I actually read the whole post, but I read it at like 3 a.m. on April 1st. And I remember going through the whole thing and saying, this sounds like, wait, oh, it is April 1st. So I'm sure it was an April Fool's Day joke, because all the references seemed too good to be true. Like, it said something like, he's now looking at Ruby, or
Oh,
I don't
so
even know, it's
it
some other
okay,
language,
yeah, that
Erlang or
that's
something.
definitely
Yeah. There was a lot of funny
okay.
things, and I haven't heard anything about it since then. And if, I think the day after that, he said he's picking Mercurial. So I think it's safe to
So I
assume
haven't I mean I
that
don't follow the Python community, so
Guido.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, that'll be huge news if
Absolutely.
Guido
I
steps
thought
down
Google basically
as.
finally told him, "You're done, you can't do this anymore."
We are only going to use Python in everything we do, but you're done.
And sort of the other sort of tidbit, and this is sentimental value, is that SGI sold their assets to Rackable Systems. Rackable Systems makes data center hardware. And the thing that really hurt was they sold them for just $25 million. And for somebody who's,
All of SGI sold for
25
25
million.
million?
To,
Oh
yeah,
my God.
it's ridiculous. And this is very, 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 I mean, this really, I mean, I spent all my grad school years with two SGIs on my desk, one on top, which was my primary machine, and a second R12000.
Must have been a rich
Oh,
lab.
absolutely.
Jeez.
I had
Yeah,
four more.
we had
Yeah,
four
I had three
RTEC.
more machines. I had a Ultra, Sun Ultra, and a Deck Alpha, so two more. Yeah, so you definitely I had my share of machines, but those were my two workhorses.
Right, same here. Yeah, I had an R10000, two
I had an
R10000s
R10K and
actually.
an
So,
R12K. So the R10K came first, R12K came second.
and I also had an Indy, so that's three SGIs. We started the Indy, and then You know, the R10Ks came along. They were so fast.
I mean, they're so beautiful.
And around then, we switched over to Linux.
The architecture was great. The way you could pull out the motherboard from the back, I always loved that. It was its own separate panel. You could just pull it out. This is great machines, rock solid. I once remember running a five-month job on my R12K. It was basically an isomerization process. And I was doing very high-end quantum calculations on each rotamer, on each step. And it didn't crash. Mm-hmm. I mean, those machines were dynamite. But SGI has made so many stupid mistakes since then. So many. From buying Cray to releasing Windows.
So I guess Cray now is also...
No, SGI they sold them Cray, off a long time ago.
Really? Okay.
SGI sold off Cray. You know, they lost their entire OpenGL team to NVIDIA back a long time ago. They did that stupid Windows thing. Which was, I think, just the beginning of the end. And they never adjusted to the fact that Linux was cheap, fast, and easy. The moment you had the render farms move on to Linux, the moment scientific computing moved on to Linux, SGI didn't respond at all. And that was it.
Yep. The beginning of the end, and this is the end. Hey, actually, okay. Can I have one more tidbit before we go for the links of the week? So... it's kind of topical. I started checking out OpenSolaris, and it is amazing. It really is it rocks. It's very cool. And the reason I started checking out OpenSolaris was because Floss Weekly actually had the ZFS, one of the members of the ZFS team, whose name I forget now, on. And ZFS is this new file system that's... hopefully, they're keeping their fingers crossed, is going to be featured in Snow Leopard, the next distribution of Apple's OS X. And OpenSolaris has ZFS out of the box. It uses ZFS as its main file system. Now, what ZFS allows you to do is basically slap a whole bunch of, SATA drives together.
Yeah,
it's supposed to be. I mean, listen to the Floss Weekly podcast.
I have
it's
heard
very
that
cool.
One. Yeah, I'm a big ZFS fan.
ZFS. Yeah, and actually, I have like two disks now. I told you how we go through like 2 terabytes of data every 2 weeks, which is still not that much, and we haven't tried pushing them to the cloud yet because it takes so long. But we're actually. I'm trying to put together a ZFS file store, and the time slider, I think that's the killer feature of ZFS right now and OpenSolaris for me. What this basically, we'll link to a screencast. Yeah. Check it out. But OpenSolaris is
I
really
actually
nice.
Think it's ZFS that's really nice.
It's it's at this point Solaris, at least OpenSolaris looks exactly like Linux.
I mean,
it uses GNOME.
KDE and talking of tidbits. So you know that IBM tried to acquire Sun, and I guess.
Today
I heard that it's been called off because they couldn't agree on price. I think IBM reduced their price, and Sun were putting consideration. IBM said, okay, we're not doing it. Doesn't mean it's over. And one of the things I was always concerned about as I was listening to this was what will happen to ZFS. Now, Sun should have killed Solaris 5 years ago. They should have adopted Linux and taken their... Sun makes great hardware. They make some of the best storage devices in the world. They have ZFS, which is killer. They should have just... move that into the Linux ecosystem. IBM has something called GFS, which is also a clustered file system, distributed file system. I think it's a distributed file system, not a clustered file system. Whatever, I forget. There's a slight distinction between the two. And my thing was, if you have that merger, which one goes away? I think ZFS is the one, but IBM likes to think theirs is better. So the other thing that was always of interest was, NetBeans versus Eclipse. Eclipse is IBM and NetBeans is Sun and so on and so forth. But there's these distributed parallel clustered file system space is really interesting. You have things like ZFS and GFS, and then there's a thing called Gluster, and of course Lustre, which is really popular with some people. So it'll be interesting to see. Yeah, ZFS is great. If Snow Leopard gets it, I'm looking forward to it. Not that I'll be able to make much use of it, but...
Actually, I think I like ZFS so much that there's nothing stopping me from moving into Solaris for a lot of my... I started off around the time I was using IRIX, I was using, Solaris also back then. This was 8 or 9 years ago. So I'm really tempted to move a lot of my stuff to Solaris because
Yeah,
it's so
just be
easy and
careful
trivial.
because Solaris might disappear.
All right. I
Yeah,
don't
no,
think so, actually.
its
I think
usage
they
is
have a
very
lot
low.
of
Their market share is pitifully low, in my
Right. I mean, there's no competing with with Linux, but
So
I
we are
like
not.
what I
You're talking
saw
about
in
ZH.
that.
We are saying we are saying we are misspeaking. It's not ZSH. It's ZFS, right? Yeah.
Yeah,
Oh,
I kept
I thought
saying
I was saying
ZFS.
ZFS, but I suddenly thought, maybe I was just saying misspeaking. Yeah. Okay.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay.
Anyway, so that was our tidbits of the week, and we've had quite a few. Let's move on to the links of the week. I heard you had a Dynamite one.
Yeah, I have one which probably it rocks. So PyCon 2000,
Yeah, go
shall I
ahead.
go first? So yeah, it's actually the all of the sessions of PyCon 2009 are, I mean, a lot of them already are on the web, and my link of the week is basically a link to the video, kind of. So it's called the URL's pycon.bibblip.tv. That's pycon.blip.tv, and I've already been watching quite a few of the afternoon lightning talks, and the quality of the video is outstanding, the audio is outstanding, and it's great to see, such a conference such as this come on so soon after the conference concluded, and be this high quality. So there's a lot of talks out there, and I think I'm going to spend the next few days like going through all this video content. So that's my link of the week. The links to all the Python what do you call videos from the recently concluded PyCon 2009 conference.
All right, I think between our links, people will get a nice dose of Python and Ruby stuff. Because
I think mine's Python every single week for
So
weeks on
this
end
time
now.
I chose a Rails-based one. As some of you probably know, there's a historically when people install Rails apps, they use Mongrel for their web server. But in recent weeks or a couple of months, the Mod Rails project, now called Fusion Passenger, has become really popular. It essentially is like mod Python and all these things.
Why do you guys have Ruby guys didn't have the most like
It's because
elaborate
this
names? Fusion
Passenger is a thing.
Passenger?
Fusion's the name of the company that did it. So it's that's because there's so many Europeans
Okay.
involved. Yeah,
I see. They have
yeah.
imagination, I
This
guess.
is
Is that Fusion with
yeah.
a
It's a
PH or a
PH
FU?
Fusion. Yeah, it's
Oh, okay.
fusion.nl or whatever. Anyway, so you need mo a lot of people, including 37 Signals, now use Apache with Passenger. So you don't need a separate web server. Like you could use Apache and Mongrel or Nginx and Mongrel. You just use Apache with Passenger installed, and it's a breeze. But one of the pains here is that every app that you have to go and try and do your vhosting in Apache, right? Which can be a pain in the
Right.
neck. So these folks at Fingertips came up with for OS X at least, came up with something called the Passenger Preference Pane, a pref pane. It's a big, just a drag and drop for Rails and Rack projects. You just drag your Rails project root into that, and it modifies Apache for you, creates the right URIs and everything. So it just makes development very easy. So let's say you have five projects. Just drag all of them on and give them a name. So when you want to type them on into your, you won't have to go localhost or whatever you have to do on the local side with vhost. Just give it a nickname, call it Demo One, and then in your browser, you just type Demo One, and voila, you have your application. So it makes working with Apache a lot much easier, especially if you have lots of Rails projects going on. So the company's name is Fingertips. It's fngtps.com. So get the if you are using Rails and are still using Mongrel, but thinking about Passenger, or just have started using Passenger, and you're on a Mac, makes life very, very easy.
Cool. Hey, this is probably our longest
I
episode so
think
far.
we sort of do that every week now, don't we? Yeah, we are over an hour, which is
Yeah.
definitely a longest episode. So let's call it a day.
Okay.
Well, one more thing, just
So here.
the usual reminders. iTunes, subscribe to us there. Send email to hurry@bioscreencast.com, and you can leave tag content on Delicious with the tag 4:C2C bio, so C the number 2 C bio, or we have a friend feed room for Coast to Coast Bio. Drop by there for comments on any existing tags or sending us new links. So I think other people have also started us sending us stuff on Delicious. Vlad sent a couple. We didn't really talk about them today, but thank you so much for sending things our way.
Chris Lasher also sent a couple of them in.
So with that, talk to you next week.
All right. Signing off. Cheers. Bye.